I think we have a rather intriguing subject this morning. And I think to understand it, we have to take a general survey of the attitudes of ancient peoples regarding the future. One of the earliest records that we have of the prophetic spirit is an inscription on the basis or base of a statue of the god Nebo of Babylon, probably dated somewhere about 2000 BC. And the god says, "That which has been will be. I am Nebo, the Lord of the writing table." Therefore, the entire concept of antiquity was that prophecy was based not upon calculations of starry portents or the consulting of more common and ordinary oracles. It was based upon the inevitable sequences of cause and effect. Whatever has been will come again if the cause comes again. And the prediction will not be dated in terms of years, but in terms of human relationships, the patterns that are set up in the various complexes of mortal society. The Great War, the last war, has occurred as a symbol in a great many different religions. It is recorded, of course, in the Bible. And probably the word Armageddon is derived from an early Palestinian term. It was the war in which the kings of the earth would make war against the hosts of heaven. And ultimately, the kings of the earth would be utterly discomfited. Perhaps the form of the story also borrows from Egypt, where it is tied closely into the myth of the dying god Osiris. Osiris, who was the principal deity of the later Egyptian recension, was foully slain by his own brother, who usurped his kingdom. After the death of Osiris, Isis, his wife, posthumously brought forth a child, Horus, the avenger of his father. Horus, the golden hawk, was the symbol of the resurrection of Osiris himself, who was said to have been reborn in his own son. And in the end, Horus led the hosts of light, their Shesti, the golden hawks, against the power and tyranny of Typhon. And there was a last great battle, and in this battle, Typhon was overcome and chained forever in the pits beneath the earth. This last great war also arises in the Hindu tradition, and the two great epics of India, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, both are concerned with a great symbolic conflict. In the Mahabharata is concealed the magnificent lines of the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord's song, in which the victory of life over death, of virtue and integrity over corruption, this victory is clearly set forth. In the Ramayana, we have another great battle, more in an epic form, and somewhat reminiscent of the Odyssey and Iliad of Homer. But it was a great battle of evil against righteousness, and righteousness prevailed. Then you remember in the Nordic rites, the last battle on the plain of Ragnarok. It was here that the gods from High Asgard, the Nordic Olympus, gathered on the plain to have that last final conflict with the powers of evil. And the battle was a terrible one. And good and bad perished together, and the earth was desolated. But one couple escaped into a high mountain, and from them came forth a new race to replenish the earth. The war that is to end war is constantly referred to in different levels of human society. Primitive tribal beliefs, highly sophisticated epics deal with this subject. So it is interesting to try to understand, perhaps, how this concept developed until it has become an enduring belief. A belief that has about it the strange circumstance that generation after generation has identified this last war with the conflicts of their own times. Wherever a great emergency has arisen, it was believed or speculated that perhaps this was the Armageddon. And because the date was never given, there was no way of confirming it. I think, however, that if we study the subject in the spirit of the Sibylline prophecies and the great prophetic books of the Bible, Isaiah and Revelation, and perhaps the Chaldean oracles of the Zoroasters, we will come to a little different point of view as to the meaning of this magnificent, elusive prophecy. I think we will discover that it traces back perhaps to an intuitive quality within man himself. I think the human being, in the depth of his own nature, is a prophet. Down beneath the surfaces of his hopes and fears, his glamours and his attitudes, there is a strange, deep pathos. The same type of thing that we find in the great ring opera of Wagner. The great symbolism of something that is going to pass away because it has not within it the integrity of its own survival. The Sibylline prophecies have to do with not a date or a time, but a sequence of events. And every sequence of events comes finally to some kind of an Armageddon. Every form of history does this. Every religion has passed through this. Every science is born and dies because of the weaknesses within its own nature. And this sequence of weaknesses, this conflict between principle and ambition, probably lies at the very root of man's enduring belief that in the end, virtue will be supreme. We see this very much about us today. We see it in the lives of individuals and in the motions of states. Probably in the last 2,000 years, we have seen strange fulfillments of warnings. We remember the admonition that those who live by the sword will perish by the sword. And this has happened many times in history. It is a prophecy that is forever fulfilling itself, not once, but many times. We recognize this tragedy of human ambition, and that it exists because of human ambition. We read of Alexander the Great, dead at 30 under the walls of Babylon. Caesar, assassinated at the foot of Pompey's column. We see Napoleon, dying of cancer on the island of St. Helena. We see Hitler, committing suicide in a bunker in Berlin. We see Mussolini, hung from a lamppost in northern Italy. The path of glory leads but to the grave. Therefore, there is some reason why these various mistakes that people make individually and collectively have a consequence which is unavoidable. We are told in the Bible that cause and effect follow each other. We are told that as ye sow, so shall ye reap. Buddha puts it in slightly different words when he says, effects follow their causes, as the wheel of the cart follows the foot of the oxen. Therefore, wherever there is a causation of catastrophe, and that causation is not transmuted, the evil is not corrected, then in the due course of time, the catastrophe comes. It is unavoidable. And down inside of ourselves, we know this, but we do not want to admit it. Each individual wants to be an exception to the law of cause and effect, but no one is an exception. And unless the individual builds his life upon integrities, he is going to inevitably come into conflict with law. Not man-made law necessarily, but the law governing life itself. For there are principles in the universe which cannot be violated. And I think the whole story of the Armageddon represents the climax of any type of sequence of events in which evil predominates. We find it in our personal lives. We find it in the story of the alcoholic. He feels that he is going to be an exception. Yet if he continues and does not correct his faults, he will die of his own shortcoming. The narcotics addict is in the same condition. There is no way of winning against the common laws of truth and reality which supervise and control all things. Even in business and politics and all the different professions, we are seeing today a great deal of harvesting. We are seeing every day how mistakes have been allowed to pile up, how individuals have placed their own advantage above the common good, and as a result have brought the common good and themselves down into ruin. We are aware that constantly that which is not true comes into conflict with the inevitable patterns of reality which cannot be violated. Every effort we make to transgress ends only in a disaster for ourselves. Now, this being the case, and most individuals having at least down somewhere in their natures at least an intimation that this is true, there comes always the problem that philosophy, culture, ethics, all these subjects have dealt with, that as the individual discovers that the integrities within himself are weakening, it is then time for him to make a strong resolution to correct his own fault. In every sequence of disasters, there is a moment when prudence, strength, courage, or integrity could transmute the evil. In every sequence of problems, there is a point at which personal integrity could solve the problem. If this is not available, if the individual does not rise to this occasion and permits the kings of this world to gain ascendancy over his life, he will then come face to face with the ultimate conflict. So it is very important, it seems, for each individual to regard the Armageddon as tied directly to himself. We are not the victims of history. We are not the victims of the earth's imperfections. We are the victims of our own mistakes. It is not heaven that brings down a nation. It is the works of humanity, misunderstood works, corrupted works, that will bring down the greatest nation the world can produce. It is all in the last analysis a problem of man's own development of integrities. Well, he drifts along with a few virtues which he is trying to live. He is hoping definitely that the heaven will forgive him for his shortcomings. There is no evidence that heaven even judged him for them. The judgment comes from himself. He knows his own shortcomings, whether he admits them or not. He may conceal them from others and hide them from his own conscience, but he knows he has them. And this type of thing produces in life after life a personal Armageddon, in which the individual must face up to his own integrities or suffer the consequences. Dissipation has its price. Corruption has its price. And most of all, self-centeredness has its price. Practically every tragedy in history has been born of human selfishness. Individuals have desired and determined to use the skills that have been given to them in a ruthless competition against their fellow human beings. We have placed profit above integrity. We have placed the struggle of competition as an inevitable truth and cooperation as a dim idealistic uncertainty. As a result of that, we have created in each department where we have compromised principles the beginnings of a story that will end in an Armageddon. In every case, we finally come face to face with the facts. We either meet them or fail. If we meet them, we have achieved the purpose of life, which is victory over weakness. If we fail to meet them, then as far as this life is concerned, we have failed regardless of how much wealth, fame, or authority we have accumulated through the corruption of principles. Now we look around and we find the world in a condition in which a number of preachers and evangelists are talking about the Armageddon. It looks like it's here again. I think this is a mistake. It is here still. It is here because it has never been met. It was here in the first time when a caveman threw a rock at another caveman. This was the beginning of war. And it will continue as long as the individual inside of himself wants to throw a rock. He may dress the rock up in a nuclear weapon, but it is still the old rock going on doing its original mischief. It is not the fact that at one time, somewhere, in a datable future, we are going to see the heavens open and the archangelic hosts come down and cleanse the earth. This is not what we are confronted with. We are confronted with the fact that in the due course of every civilization, every person's life, every invention, art, science, craft, trade, there are rules. And if these rules are broken, universal law, which is always here, steps in and balances the books. When this happens, a lot of misery seemingly occurs. Individuals are frustrated in all their ambitions and all their prides. But it is either that they shall have that bad moment and then gradually come back to integrity, or they will destroy everything that they have hoped to gain. Now, we are in the very edge of a very difficult international world situation. We are in the presence of an accumulation of thousands of years of mistaken activity. Now, in most people's minds, the worst mistakes have been the most pleasant occurrences. The individual has found that it is possible for him to have more money than his neighbor. It is possible for him to be elected to public office and have quite a following. It is possible for him to be a lawmaker and make many laws that are especially beneficial to himself. He has all kinds of opportunities. And we see around us a world of trade, of barter, exchange, of investment, of speculation, a world of individuals all working desperately for their own benefit. Now, this is regarded as virtuous. Why shouldn't we go out and work for our own benefit? Why should we give any consideration to anybody else? Why should we put someone else's good whom we don't even know above our own opportunity to do unusually well? The answer is that we are part of a collective. And the moment we begin to corrupt our neighbors, the moment we begin to exploit each other, each man exploits himself, but he doesn't know it. He is gradually building for the complete destruction of the system he has abused. And somewhere along the line, there will always be what has been produced by nature over thousands of years. There will be prophets. There will be someone arise who sees the facts, who tries to do something about it. Perhaps he is accepted, more likely he is rejected because he interferes with the personal privileges of the individual. Some cases he has been martyred, in many cases he has been ridiculed. But always along the way, there comes a moment or a time in which the facts are available and the individual can learn. This is his big decision. Whether he is big enough, wise enough, and virtuous enough to sacrifice something of his own ambitions to accomplish the preservation of the society to which he belongs. If he does not have this desire, he will then drift with it until it all falls apart together. For the problems that destroy society are the injustices allowed to linger within the nature of the human being himself. As long as they are there, trouble will continue. Another field where Armageddon shows up quite repeatedly is in domestic relationships. Young people starting out in marriage are filled with hopes and filled with aspirations. They think they're going to be able to make a wonderful life. But very few sit down for a moment, even before this fatal step is taken, to determine what they are really thinking, what they really believe, what they actually want. Do they really want to build a strong relationship? Or do they want to unite for some type of personal profit? Are they out for something they want to take rather than what they want to give? Are they more inclined to be self-centered? Do their own ambitions transcend the family good? Do they neglect each other or their children in the search of privileges for their own pleasure? If so, they are building up an Armageddon. There'll come a time when perhaps they'll settle down and have a long heart-to-heart talk about it. If something good comes out of that, perhaps the home is preserved. On the other hand, if in this discussion each individual remains set in his ways and determined to have his own way at the cost of all else, then the war breaks out. Then the kings of the earth go to war against the hosts of heaven. For the integrities of life are heaven bestowed, and the inequities come from the hosts of earth. So everywhere we go, anywhere we turn, we will find that there are opportunities to arbitrate the great conflict. Perhaps we can't arbitrate it indefinitely or completely, but if we try, we can always lift a great deal of the burden. We can correct some faults that are possible for us to correct, and in that way add further vitality and endurance to our civilization and our way of life. So in this problem, the problem that has annoyed, worried, or bestirred many people for a long, long time is that what is to happen? And we are told that after the Armageddon, or after the loss of the war of Kurukshetra, after the Golden Hawk has won against the hosts of Typhon, there comes the new heaven and the new earth. Now, this can happen in the individual also. A lot of theologians feel that if an individual turns from a very secular type of life and accepts spiritual instruction and rededicates his career to the service of principles, that he is born again, that he has created inside of himself a new heaven and a new earth, that he has found the strength of peace and integrity and charity and kindness. If these transformations take place within the person, then truly we are facing inside of ourselves the millennium. The old prophets also carried the idea that after the last great war, there would be a new heaven and a new earth, not only within us, but within the great world environment in which we live. If the selfishness is taken out of ourselves, the corruption of our natural resources is prevented. If we build our lives upon principles, then we will fail to destroy the planet on which we live. And if we are truly intelligent and wise and thoughtful, then comes the Paraclete, or the Prince of Peace. Then comes a new law and a new cycle of existence, and we shall follow the way of heaven instead of the way of earth. And if we follow the way of heaven, we will be blessed by the virtues and integrities within ourselves. But there is no possible way in which we can pile up a defense of vices which will protect us in an emergency. No matter what we do, unless we change the basic principle of life, making integrity the final criterion of all things, until then we are in danger. We are in danger not because heaven wishes to destroy us, but because we choose to destroy ourselves. So we are all concerned now quite a bit, and we wonder what is going to happen. Are we going to be able to handle this difficulty? Again, we can look about us and see what is happening. We observe all kinds of emergencies arising, and we find, we might almost say, the last desperate stand of that which must inevitably fail. We are witnessing a condition in which, unless there is a major change of integrities, we are not going to be able to solve the problem. We are never going to be able, in military way, to bring peace to the earth. We will never be able, in the exploitation of resources, to attain security. We can never buy our way to peace any more than the Roman Empire could buy its way to peace. All these things have been tried before. We can never control so much that what we control cannot revolt against us. There is only one possibility to the solution of all difficulties, and that is that all the nations and all the beliefs claiming the same thing shall obey their own claim, namely, that there is a fundamental integrity as stated by religion, as supported by philosophy, and as being gradually discovered by science. And if this is not used, then most of our hopes are in vain. On the other hand, there is something else that we have to recognize. Namely, that if in our own hearts and minds we make the necessary adjustments, it may well be that just because we are little people, without very much authority or power, that we are not going to be able to change the course of history. As individuals, we cannot. It is only as groups that we can have a powerful influence. The more persons who see the facts, the safer the world will become. But in that transitional period in which perhaps we believe we have seen some facts, and we worry and are gravely concerned because of the conditions around us, then I think it is very definitely necessary to realize that the law of cause and effect, which is producing these circumstances is not a law of extermination. It is not a law in which the end of universal process is annihilation. It is a law in which, in the long and greater span of things, it is necessary to prevent corruption from gaining too strong a hold upon the world. It is part of a plan that says, when you make a mistake, you are punished. And as a result of a few punishments, you learn not to make the mistake. You may hold out for quite a while, but in the end, the punishments which come as the result of wrong living will discourage the mistakes. They will not go on. Man will not exterminate himself. Man will not destroy himself, because he can make himself massively uncomfortable. He can get into more scrapes and problems than he ever wants to face. But there is within the human spirit itself an incorruptible, which is going to fight on until it wins. But it has to win in the service of truth. It cannot win in any other way. Many nations of the past have failed and faded away from us. And each of these nations more or less perished as the result of an Armageddon. It was this type of internal corruption that destroyed the Grecian states, destroyed Egypt, brought down Asia in ruin, and destroyed very largely the whole cultural system of the Mediterranean and Western Europe. The conditions follow that pattern. Nations have faded away. Whole processes of hope have vanished. And yet humanity has gone on. Humanity is a strangely wonderful, vital thing. It is something that continues and goes on, but leaves behind the ruins of its own mistakes. Now, it's always hoped that the individual will not be forced again to go through so strenuous and perhaps so painful a process of regeneration. The old Rosicrucians referred to the universal reformation, the conscious creation of the army of the Golden Hawk. In the case of the Nordic rites, Odin and the Aces of Mount Asgard gathered together the heroes from the battlefields of life. They gathered up all of those who died in the defense of good causes. And the Valkyrie carried these heroes to the eternal feasting of the gods. And from them was formed the last army that was to protect heaven against the ravages of the underworld. In the Egyptian story, the Golden Hawk, they were the enlightened ones. They were the ones who saw the truth. They were the soldiers of the cross. They were the ones who fought not with guns or swords and spears, but fought with truth, with integrity, with the armament of wisdom, of patience and forgiveness. And this army of the Golden Hawk represents that ever-increasing group of human beings who begin to understand, who are no longer completely dominated by the corruptions of their time. And we see this army forming everywhere, even now. In one nation, there is a great move toward peace. In another nation, there are reforms in the living conditions. In another nation, we have a liberalization of education. In still other areas, different religions are getting together. But where they do not get together, then we have the making of an Armageddon. We have a making of a great struggle based upon an intolerance. Where tolerance exists, there is a new army of light to help causes out. Then we find movements, organizations everywhere, seeking justice, seeking integrity. We have a great revival of religion in many parts of the world as a first defense, because after all, the army of the hawk or the army of the light must be spiritually integrated, spiritually inspired. It must not expect God to be on its side, but it must be on the side of God. And in these dedications and reconsecrations, thousands, millions of young people who grew up in a generation of atheism and agnosticism are beginning to recognize the tremendous need for spiritual integrities. And gradually this change in human nature is going to result in the development of the protecting army. The army of the light is also being formed. And somewhere along the line, the army of the light must face the army of darkness. And if the light is sincere and honest, then the darkness will be overcome. No corruption can withstand the strength of direct and honorable virtue. So that we are watching as this problem is producing its own panacea. There will be an alignment somewhere along the way in which the forces that believe in truth must come head-on into confusion or into collision with the forces who deny the existence of any truth except self-gratification. This may come, but on the other hand, it may simmer down into nothing more or less than a gradual change of point of view. Because millions of people, as soon as they realize that they have support, will turn toward righteousness and turn toward truth because it is happier, it is more pleasant, more protective of all the values and virtues with which we are concerned. The fact that young people are beginning to need religion and find it, that many, many people are rebelling against corruption in every walk of life, means that in time, these rebellions will cement into a new point of view. And if this new point of view comes, the war may not be a head-on collision at all, but a gradual shift of perspective with a few adjustments and a few people with headaches, but the majority of individuals rejoicing in a better state of things. It is amazing that the human being should be satisfied to be miserable. It is hard to understand how we are willing to do so many unpleasant things and gain out of it nothing but further unpleasantness. Why does it happen that we nurse grievances, fully aware that the more we nurse them, the more we will grieve? Why not get over the grievance in the first place? Why should we spend a life nursing hatreds? Why should we look back and remember every unhappy thing that has been done to us and completely forget any unhappy things we did to other people? Why do we have these habits? Well, it seems to be that the reason we have them is because they are part of a common heritage of ignorance to which we are all indebted. An inheritance of it's always been that way, therefore it always will be. My ancestors didn't like each other, why should I? We don't realize that when we look back on our ancestors that they died of their dislikes. And that with these dislikes they created wars and crimes and overcame good things, impoverished themselves and their families. And yet we keep right on doing it. There is, however, nature stepping in. Nature knows that there is a potential for solution inside of the human being. That down at the very depths of ourselves, we are honorable. That regardless of all the incrustations of errors that surface us, the depths are honest. Because at the very root and source and depth of ourselves is the divine principle by which we exist. The spirit in us, the divine power in us, is uncorrupted. But it is bound and burdened. It is imprisoned within a pattern of attitudes, a way of selfishness, and an endless determination to gratify our superficial desires. We have just refused to permit the best part of ourselves to come through. This probably is one of the interesting aspects of Zen Buddhism and some of the Oriental philosophies that we are just beginning to appreciate. Nearly all of them are based upon one basic principle: be still and know that I am God. In quiet meditation, in relaxation away from worldly possessions, detachments from false ambitions, the individual finally can reach communion with himself. He can find the reason for his own existence if he will be quiet, if he will release and relax, and will get away for a while from the tremendous pressures of temporality. If he will get over the idea that he has to have a bigger house, or that he needs another swimming pool, or that his car is an antique because it's 6 months old, he will have a little time for something else. And difficulties arising now are cutting desperately into the profit theory that most people have lived by. We are beginning to find that it's getting tighter. And regardless how we feel, we must partly blame ourselves for the existing conditions. We have spoiled ourselves. Now we are suffering from the results of this spoilage. So with a little quietude, a little integrity, the individual will begin to simplify life. And as he does this, he gradually separates himself from the factors that would involve him in the strenuous revolution of an Armageddon. The individual who is willing to begin the orientation of himself and begins to put value where it belongs will find that it is true that thousands can fall on the right hand and thousands on the left, but the just man shall not be moved. When we begin to understand the reason for things, we are not going to be constantly agitated and distressed because some of our luxuries are impaired. We are going to realize that the whole program of nature is to get man back on the path, get him going in the direction he should be going, the direction that leads ultimately to peace and security for himself and his world. Now, in the old Sibylline days, these prophetesses are said to have been members of a kind of secret organization, and that these prophetesses all predicted that in the fullness of time a Redeemer would come, that at the proper moment a new king would arise after the Armageddon, and the world should be ruled by a divine power.